Hey, folks, this is Andrew Perella, producer of Something Wild. Thanks for subscribing and listening to our podcast. You know, these podcasts are a great opportunity to give you a little bit more of what you love about Something Wild. Chris and Dave are, of course, incredibly knowledgeable hosts, and when they sit down with other biologists, the conversations are fascinating. Like today's with Susie Van Ottingen and Emily Preston, a pair of biologists whom we affectionately refer to as the Bat Ladies. We get to bring you more of this conversation than we had time for on the air, and it's really good stuff. But it does take time, effort, resources, all that stuff to put these special podcast episodes together. So because you like what you hear, kick in a few bucks, just 5 or 10, to help us continue doing what we do. Just go to nhprfundrive.org, make your gift there, and thank you as always for your support. Now, without further ado. This is Something Wild. I'm Chris Martin.
And I'm Dave Anderson.
You know, we're facing a problem in the state.
I know, political season.
No, I'm talking about environmental issues, Dave. With bats.
Oh, you're talking about white nose syndrome.
The bat population in New Hampshire has been dwindling due to a fungal infection.
Wildlife biologist Emily Preston from New Hampshire Fish and Game and endangered species biologist Susie Van Ottingen from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service have been working closely with bats throughout this epidemic.
So we caught up with them to talk about what's been happening and how things are looking for the bats now. Susie, Emily, thanks for coming.
Pleasure. Well, thanks for having us.
So the first basic question is, what role do bats play in our ecosystem?
Well, bats are really important in the ecosystem because they are the greatest predator of night-flying insects. So any insect that flies at night could be prey for bats. And because in New Hampshire, we have 8 species of bats, that's a lot of bats.
And a lot of night-flying insects, too.
Absolutely.
Now that we're getting to October, have the bats already left, the ones that are migrating?
Well, the bats, depending on the species and depending on whether they're male or females, they start going into hibernation or migrating at different times. So the females often go into hibernation earlier than the males. Once they've mated, they go into hibernation. And I would think that the female migratory tree bats are also migrating at the same time. And we have long-distance migrants and short-distance migrants, and some stay within New Hampshire and some leave New Hampshire.
So it's a complicated mix.
It is. And so this time of year, you're going to see some movement, though most of it may have already happened.
So one thing we want to talk about is white-nose syndrome. What exactly is white-nose syndrome, and where did it come from?
Well, white nose syndrome is a fungus that we have determined has originated in Europe. Ooh. And in Europe, the bats seem to coexist with the fungus. There are at least 13 species that have been documented to have it. But somehow it made its way across to the U.S. We don't know whether it was on an article of clothing or maybe a bat caught a ride on a boat and ended up in Albany, New York.
Wow.
So we found it in 2006, winter of 2006-2007, and it's been affecting bats ever since.
So once it got to the U.S., it just took off.
It did, because it's an exotic species. Nothing could stop it.
What species of bats occur in New Hampshire, and which are the most vulnerable in New Hampshire?
So there's the big brown bat and the little brown bat, and those are the ones that people are most familiar with because they are the ones that use people's houses in the summer for roosting. Mm-hmm. We also have the northern long-eared bat, the tricolored bat, and the eastern small-footed bat, and that last bat is actually endangered in New Hampshire.
So is there a difference between migratory bats and non-migratory bats in terms of their vulnerability to white-nose syndrome?
Sure. The migratory bats tend to fly south where it's warmer, and so they're not doing a full hibernation. They're not going into the cold, damp cave environment, which is where that fungus really flourishes. So the bats that are not going into those spaces and spending the winter, there's not much of a possibility for the fungus to actually grow on them.
And I've read that the little brown bat is the most common bat in New Hampshire, the most familiar, and that one has been hit the hardest. Somebody said like a 98% or 99% in reduction. So 99 out of 100 little brown bats are gone, and I think people are noticing. What percentage of the total bat population has been affected by white nose syndrome?
Well, I think right now what the Fish and Wildlife Service is looking at is a 90% decline pretty much for little brown bats and certainly for northern long-eared bats, maybe even greater for northern long-eared bats. We have tricolored bats, and those are also exhibiting at least a 90% decline. Big brown bats, not as much. I don't know what it is. 50, 75% maybe, 50%, not hit as hard. And small-footed bats, for some reason, aren't being hit as hard either. So the ones we're looking at really are little brown, northern long-eared, and tricolored, right. And they're being decimated.
So I'm just thinking about the bats that I would see around my yard in the evenings in maybe 10 years ago. My senses is mostly little brown and big brown bats. And now you look out in the evening and you see, if you're lucky if you see one flying around.
It really does depend on where you are. We do still, fortunately, have some good colonies of little brown bats, and we certainly do of big brown bats, since they seem to be less susceptible to white nose syndrome.
But we have a colony in Charlestown, New Hampshire. It's so exciting. At least 5 or 6 years, and those numbers are stable, 200 or so bats. And right across the river in Vermont, nothing. So what's special about New Hampshire little brown bats there?
And what's really exciting is that when we go in and do the surveys of that barn, we actually put little bands on the wings of the bats. So we know that individual females have been coming back all that time. It's not that it's different bats coming in. It's the same ones that are successfully breeding. They are raising pups. Hopefully those pups are doing well. Maybe whatever it is that caused those females to survive, they're passing on to those babies. Since we don't know what it is, we don't know if that's true, but that's what we're really hoping.
So what we're really talking about there is, I would call, a bottleneck, a population bottleneck, where most of the animals of the population have been wiped out, but some, for one reason or another, have survived. What is it that those particular animals have that the others didn't?
We don't actually know. So there's some work in Pennsylvania, in a place that they had captured before white nose syndrome. They captured a bunch of bats, weighed them, banded them. Then they came back after white nose syndrome and found some of the exact same bats. Those banded bats were much heavier. In other words, those bats were eating a lot more insects in the fall. And when they went into hibernation, they had much greater stores of fat. And that's individuals changing their behavior in the face of this disease. Now, we don't know if they can pass that on to their youngsters, because they aren't out there training their youngsters saying, okay, little Bobby, it's time to be catching lots of bats today.
Eat more.
Bugs today. Skip that whole piece, will you? They're not training. They don't actively train their young on how to hunt insects, so they are not able to pass that on. But maybe there's something genetically in those bats that allows them to be adaptive to this changing situation.
And also the larger individuals seem to be more resistant to the fungus than the smallers. And by species, the larger bat species, which are built for migrating out as opposed to smaller, seem to have a little bit more resistance, maybe because of fat reserves.
It may very well be.
I want to go back to the fungus. The fungus white nose syndrome, what's special about that? It sounds like it's very complex, and there's a lot of site considerations and species considerations. But some people have suggested that this is a fungus. Couldn't you simply employ some kind of an antifungal treatment in the caves that would be helpful for the bats? That's kind of the simplistic or overly.
We always want to fix things.
Yeah, we do.
It is a fungus. But in those same cave situations where the bats are and this fungus is, there's a lot of other fungi in there. And that's part of that whole cave ecosystem. Now, in New Hampshire, where most of our hibernacula are old mines and they haven't been around really long enough to evolve their own fungal communities, you could probably spray the caves, the mines. But in other parts of the country, that wouldn't be at all possible.
Or the caves have been there for tens of thousands of years,
thousands of years. And they have a complex cave community. The other piece of that is that you're dealing with a small flying animal that's very sensitive to what's around it. The echolocation that bats use really is very precise in terms of them knowing what's around them. It's hard to catch them. They can even avoid nets. They actually know that they're there and fly up over them. If you try to misting, people say, well, I'm not misting them. Well, they can see the mist, and they will see that as a barrier and decide not to fly through it. Mm-hmm. Also, most fungal treatments take multiple treatments to actually get rid of the fungus.
I stub my toe just going from the bedroom to the bathroom at night.
So there's no simple, easy fix, like just let's treat the fungus and then the problem is over. Now, European bats have shown some resistance to white nose fungus, and some have suggested that they're living with it, or they've...
They are living with it. It's coexistence, and it could be that they went through a similar situation but many centuries ago.
So if the European bat population are thought to have come through this, then potentially North American bats or the hibernacula in New Hampshire that are showing still healthy numbers potentially could be the basis or the seed population of what will become the bats of New England in the future, those that survive this crash.
That survive this crash, because we know, we're hoping that all species will. We're not sure that they all can continue this decline.
But it makes it all the more important that we do what we can to protect bat habitat now, because we only have a few pieces that we're working with.
Right.
I mean, presumably, we could look back on this 50 years from now and we'll have healthy bat populations again because of their ability to rebound. I mean, similar to what we've got with some of our birds of prey that have rebounded. Or do you think this is not the case? What are your concerns?
It's going to take hundreds of years for a rebound. Bats.
Hundreds of years.
Right, because you've got an animal that's a long-lived animal. A lot of our long-lived animals only have a few babies a year. And in bats' case, it's one or two, usually just one, in most of our species. Mm-hmm. All of those babies are subject to the same issues that other babies. There's predators, and there's trying to learn how to fly. There's mistakes. There's other kinds of diseases and things. There's everything. So not all those survive. We are hoping that we will have some survivors. You know, we know that there are babies being born, and they are healthy when we're handling them in the summertime. And in other states, we're seeing some stabilization in these winter populations. We're not seeing that in New Hampshire, but partly it's because our hibernacula are very small. And so our largest one was under 2,000 bats. So that's very tiny. And we're really not seeing any of that stabilization.
So there is news from New York that some of those caves, the precipitous declines have actually stopped, or the decline is reversed, is what you're saying. That's the news from the caves that we're hearing now?
It's stabilizing. So they've lost, 99%, and that 1% seems to be hanging on for multiple years.
It's hard to call any of this good news until you can demonstrate that populations are growing.
The good news is they're not down to zero.
Yes.
I'll take what I can get. But there's some stabilization, like the little browns at certain sites in New Hampshire. Northern long ears, not so much.
I would not characterize any stabilization in New Hampshire.
No.
No. In the 2 years that we have done, over the last 2 years, we've surveyed all of our normally surveyed sites. We had a total of 32 bats. 25 of those were big brown bats. So it's just not very many bats at all. Three of those were eastern small-footed bats, and then the others were northern long-eared bats.
So you're saying it's way too soon to be optimistic about this. We're not out of the woods yet.
We're definitely not out of the
no.
woods yet. We don't have the data in New Hampshire to talk about what's actually going to happen in New Hampshire.
What I do want to get at, and I want to ask this question, is rather than experimental treatments, it sounds like a true white nose syndrome resistance is really what people are hoping on, rather than any kind of experimental treatment.
Faith in nature, in other words, to solve its own problem.
Over time.
That's certainly what we're hoping for. The disease is so widespread. It affects so many species. There are so many issues in treatment. But what we're really hoping is these bats are actually adapting to this new disease. And the ones that we have left are indeed passing on whatever it is that's helping them survive to their offspring.
So is somebody documenting that it's not just bats that are living a long time and surviving, but that their offspring are also able to live with this disease?
You know, that is a great question, Chris. And I don't know if anybody's able to do it right now. It would require a lot of genetic sampling. And there, I believe, is some genetics trying to figure out if these survivors are different. But to be able to trace female to offspring is really, really different.
So you mentioned this colony in Charlestown. Are there other examples, or is there anything that the listeners can do to help provide you with information?
Well, we have been following a colony on a New Hampshire Audubon property, which still seems to be doing quite well. And what we encourage people to do if they have bats is to give them the best kind of roosting structure that they can. And frankly, that tends to be a barn. Mm-hmm. Bats like to be, both little brown and big brown bats like to be in big groups. Their pups are all crowded together. They stay warmer that way. So all of the food, that rich mother's milk that they're drinking, is going towards growth. And if they are in a warm or hot colony with lots of others, they just seem to grow faster and better and stronger. Mm. So we encourage people that are comfortable living with bats to leave them where they are.
And I got to tell you a story. I was so excited. So we have one or two big brown bats floating around the house, which is really exciting because we used to have lots more bats.
And floating around inside?
Outside.
Okay.
And I put up a bat house this June. Finally, me, a bat biologist, waited how many years to put up a bat house? 19 came out.
19.
And they were babies and adults. It was like within 2 months, I had 19 big browns. And now they move around from site to site, but every once in a while, I'll see them in my bat house.
Well, that's actually that's a small little sliver, but that's good news.
It is great news. Yeah. It is great news. And so if you have a few bats floating around, put up a bat house in a nice, hot spot. Hot and sunny. Don't think cold. They need hot.
Yeah. And even in the summertime.
Them. Yes. And I helped another lady. She had them in her barn. We put up a bat house right on the front of her barn. Not the best place to park a car, but she got all her bats, moved into the big bat house. So I would suggest if you have bats and you want to encourage better growth, as Emily was explaining, put up a bat house.
So Susie mentioned actually the listing of the northern long-eared bat on the federal endangered species list, and I wonder what the effect of that is here in New Hampshire.
Well, for private forestry on private lands, there is really no effect unless the landowner actually knows that there are bats there, which generally nobody does. That's near hibernacula. For state lands, what we've been doing is going out and doing that acoustic recording work on any of our lands that we plan on doing a harvest, a summertime harvest. So we're collecting data which can be then used with this other data that we've been collecting to help understand where these animals are on the landscape.
Well, it's been fascinating to talk about bats today. I've learned a lot, more than I ever realized was going on with bats. And thank you both for coming in.
Well, thank you for having us. This is great fun.
You're welcome. It's always fun to talk about bats.
Yeah.
And if you have a question about bats or anything regarding the natural world in New Hampshire, email us at somethingwild@nhpr.org. I'm Dave Anderson.
And I'm Chris Martin. Something Wild is a joint production of New Hampshire Audubon, the Society for the Protection of New Hampshire Forests, and NHPR.